not yours.
It's a different class.
These are not.
One thing, sir. Okay, so there's one semester that I actually got a gong. And I put it right next to the mic and hit it because it shocked people up. Okay, so are you guys ready or not? Okay, let's get started. I'm going to start with the two questions I'm going to start with pretty much every class for the next few sessions. Is there anybody in this class who's not in a group yet? Not in a group. Rest of you are in groups then? Kind of? If you're not in a group, keep your hands up because I want you to see each other, because I have a very simple way of creating a group. Just two people? Three? Four? Hey, that's your group right there. 1, 2, 3, 4. Right. At least get started. If this is not the way you want to create a group, remember the orphan list that I put up. Right? I've been sending you links to it. Go in and put yourself on the list and put yourself up for adoption. And I'll push as best as I can so group can take an additional person. That's why I wanted some clarity on what you're going to be valuing so that they know what they're getting. So I want everybody to be in a group as soon as possible. Now let me ask you the second question. And this I expect more people to say they have it. How many of you have not picked a company yet? Okay. That's exactly where I expect to be. I hope by the end of this week you've picked a company. My only recommendation to you is pick one. You can always change your mind. You're not locked in. So if you pick a company, you don't like it, 3 weeks from now, 5 weeks from now, 7 weeks from now, you can shift. And it's actually, once you put the work in on one company, it replicates. You can use it on other companies. The worst thing you can do is not pick a company, not do the work associated with a project for 5 weeks, and then pick one. I'd rather that you pick the wrong company early and change your mind later than not pick a company at all. Okay? I know a few of you have emailed me about specific company choice. Is this one okay? Is this one okay? Is this one okay? Recognize that this is more for your psychological comfort than for me to tell you. Any company is okay. It's just different kinds of challenges. Okay, so let's pick up. We're going to start today on the meat and potatoes part, evaluation. So we're going to lay the foundations for, hey, what is intrinsic valuation? What are we trying to do in discounted cash flow evaluation? You're saying, where's the start of the class test? It's actually going to be about 15 minutes into the session. So if you took a look at that page that I sent you, I can see look on your face, what page? I don't remember a page. I know. There was a page I sent you. You just didn't look at it. But don't worry. I'll pull the page up. I'll pull it up about 15 minutes into the class. Okay? So we're going to start on building the blocks for intrinsic valuation. So let me lay the foundations for what we're going to try to do. In intrinsic value, You estimate the value for an asset based on its specific characteristics, its cash flows, its growth, its risk. Okay. Now, that sounds pretty complicated, right? What does that even mean? I'm going to try to make this as simple as possible. It's a present value equation. There are two ways you can approach valuing a risky asset. Here's the first and the more common way. You take expected cash flows on the asset across all good scenarios, bad scenarios. You take the expected cash flows, and you discount those expected cash flows at a risk-adjusted discount rate. This is the more conventional way in which you value companies, is we take expected cash flows and we discount back at a risk-adjusted discount rate. That's approach one. There is another way in which you can approach it. Thank you, Dr. There is another way in which you can do discounted cash flow valuation. You can take what are called certainty equivalent cash flows and discount them at a risk-free rate. People talk about this all the time, but they really have no idea what they're talking about, so let's make this specific. Let's take a simple example. Let's suppose you're thinking about investing in Venezuela. Bad idea, but you want to do it. And here's what the outcomes look like. 90% of the time, it's going to be a one-year project. 90% of the time, you're going to get $100 million. The remaining 10% of the time, your business is going to get nationalized, and you're going to get nothing. Okay? So let's try the first approach. What's the expected cash flow on this investment? Come on. The math, you should be, don't pull out calculators. You should be 90% chance of making $100 million, 10% chance of making zero. The expected cash flow is $90 million. And you would discount the $90 million at a risk-adjusted discount rate. You see why risk-adjusted? Because that $90 million is not guaranteed. If I gave you a $90 million guaranteed cash flow, it's very different. So you would adjust the discount rate for the risk in the investment, come up with an expected value. That's the first approach. In the second approach, what you would do is you take the $90 million that you get as an expected cash flow and ask a follow-up question. What guaranteed cash flow would I need to get to be willing to exchange the $90 million for? Have you seen the Howie Mandel show with the deal? This is exactly it, right? Basically, you're given a guaranteed cash flow. It says, do you want what's in the suitcase? People that really do really stupid things. So don't take that as your template. But let me ask you a question. If I came to you and said, I will offer you a guaranteed cash flow instead of the $90 million. Let's start with the easy question. Does that guaranteed cash flow have to be less than $90 million or more than $90 million? Less, right? Because I'm replacing a risky investment where you get expected cash flow of $90 million with something less than $90 million. Why? Because we're human beings. We're risk-averse. If we were truly risk-neutral, we'd be okay with $90 million. But to the degree that we're risk-averse, we're going to demand less than $90 million. Again. And the more risk there is in that expected cash flow, the less of the guaranteed cash. But you can already see, if I went around that room, how much you would need as your replacement will vary across individuals depending on your risk aversion. We'll come back and talk about what drives risk aversion later in this class, but that's the way to think about certainty equivalent cash flows. You take each expected cash flow, and instead of using the expected cash flow, you use the certainty equivalent, 84, 85, 86 million. But because you've adjusted the cash flow, the discount rate you should be using should be a risk-free rate. You know the one thing you cannot do? Double count. In other words, if you take your expected cash flows, replace them with certainty equivalent cash flows, and risk adjust the discount rate, you're counting risk twice. So you have to make up your mind early where you're going to bring in risk. And in most traditional discounted cash flow valuation, it's going to show up in the discount rate. So you ready for some intrinsic valuation 101? I want a guinea pig. Don't worry, I'll make you look really good. Does anybody want to volunteer? Somebody who's never done valuation. You've done valuation before? Okay, good. You already know valuation. In fact, I'm going to use a very simple experiment to illustrate this because it is not complicated. Okay? So I have an envelope. Don't worry, I'm not a magician. I'm not going to do strange things. No? I'm going to put $20 into this envelope. So, again, no tricks. Nothing else is going in. How much would you pay for this envelope? Good. Because most people, when you show them this, you know what their answer is going to be, right? They saw the $20 go in, they offer me $20. If you pay $20 for an envelope with $20, what do you end up with? An envelope, which I stole from upstairs. So the first lesson in valuation is, if you know the value of something, don't start your bidding at that number. Start at one. In fact, you might want to start at one. Who knows what disease I have? Maybe I can't read numbers. It's a tall order, but you never know what you might get. But this is a simple asset to value, right? Even Wasserstein Perella should not have any trouble with this asset. And everybody saw the $20. If I open this up to a bidding war, at the end of the bidding war, my guess is we're going to end up roughly at $20. Now we're going to make this interesting, because I'm going to add stuff to this $20. And I want to tell... That's not good if it falls out, no? I want you to tell me, as I go through these lists of items that I add, how much you would add to the value. So read to the class what this says.
Control.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do, people. I'm going to add control to the $20. Now, there's $20 plus control. How much would you pay for the envelope now? It's already at 20, so you can't go below 20. But I've added control to it. Should be worth a little bit more, right? 25, okay. Give me the 25. You thought this was a game. If you actually paid 25, think of what you've just done. You paid $5 for a 3x5 card. There's no control premium in it. It's a 3x5 card on which I wrote the word control, and I stole that too. Actually, you said 25. You're not the only one. I did this at Goldman Sachs, the M&A team, a few weeks ago. And, of course, I opened this up, and the guy at the banker, the very, very enthusiastic banker, said, puts up his hands, 24. I sold it to him. He says, but I didn't mean it. I said, now that it's your own money, that 20% control premium is starting to bite, right? You can see where this is going next. What does it say? Synergy. That's a big one. I'm going to put that in there. But again, it's a 3x5 card with the word synergy. I can write all kinds of neat stuff. How about brand? Let's see what I can do there. What does this say? Brand name. If you're a marketing person, you're doing somersaults in the air and say, this is wonderful, 3x5 card. Basically, my point is that after I add all of this stuff, all you have is $20 plus 3x5 cards with nice-sounding words. I call these weapons of mass distraction. You know why I call them weapons of mass distraction? Because they show up and the numbers don't fly. You want to buy a company, you work through the numbers, it doesn't look like you should be paying the price that you are thinking about paying. You really want to buy the company anyway. So what do? You call it a control premium. You say there's synergy. In fact, I'll give you two secret words you can use to justify paying far more than anything is worth. Use it on other people, make them pay, because it's so much more fun when somebody else pays. The first is the word strategic. A word I beat up in my corporate finance class, and I'll continue to beat up. It's the most dangerous word in business. You know what it means? The numbers don't fly, but I really want to do it. A strategic deal is a really stupid deal. But you want to do it anyway. A strategic buyer? This is a buyer who makes up his mind on how much to pay before he shows up at the bargaining table. But here's the trump card, the word that has worked very well in the last 10 years if you're trying to sell something for way more than it's worth. What does it say?
China.
Try it, right? Whatever the company is, it's not working, just throw in China. It's amazing how good sense leaves out of the window. So I'm going to state some very simple propositions about intrinsic valuation that are going to drive how we think about intrinsic value. There is no theory. It's basic equation, one equation. So the first proposition is what I call the it proposition. If it does not affect the cash flows and it does not affect risk, what the heck are we doing talking about it? Like what? Like control, like synergy. Ask you a question. What's the value of control? What does control do? It gives you a chance to run the company through the existing people, right? So now let's flesh it out. What is the value of being able to do that? you would run the company differently than the existing people would, right? So to value control, what do you need to do? You need to value the company twice. Once with the existing management in place, and once with you in place, and the difference is the value of control. It's not 20%. It's not a card on which I write the word control. It has to be explicit. The same thing with synergy. We want to talk about synergy. Let's talk specifics. You bring two companies together. You're telling me you can do things that you could not have done as individual companies. What are those things? Increase revenues, lower costs. My job then is to bring them into the cash flows and bring them into the risk. This is the value of synergy. So I'm not saying control doesn't have value and synergy doesn't have value, but if we're going to use words like that, then we have the obligation to think about how it shows up in the cash flows and how it affects value. It proposition. Here's my second proposition. It's called the duh. Proposition. It's named after my daughter. I have three sons and a daughter, and I love them all most of the time. Yeah. But I've noticed something very insidious with all my kids. Around the age of two and a half, they thought I knew everything on the face of the earth. They'd ask questions like, Dad, what's the meaning of the universe? And I'd make up stuff, and they couldn't check it anyway. But sometime between the age of 2 and 3, this is the insidious part would happen. They'd go to bed one night thinking I knew everything on the face of the earth, and they'd wake up the next morning, and I magically knew less. And once this starts, it continues. So every day you're getting stupider and stupider and stupider and stupider. My son stopped thinking about my existence around the age of 11 and 12, so they basically moved on. My daughter's was, I mean, this is, I guess, a characteristic that they stay obsessed on how stupid you are. So she kept track of how stupid I was getting. And around the age of 16, she decided I was the stupidest person on the face of the earth. I had the misfortune of sitting across the dinner table from her. And there'd be topics of conversation that would come up, but I thought I had something to contribute. So the topic would come up, I'd open my mouth. My daughter would look across the table at me, Dad, duh. And the amount of contempt that oozed out of that word was so much that I stopped talking for 2 years. The good news is around the age of 18, she went to sleep one night thinking I was the stupidest person. Next morning when she woke up, I'd moved up the ranks. I was still among the 100 stupidest, but I was now the 7th. So I think I'm moving in the right direction now. But here's what the duh proposition is reserved for. Every week I get at least a half a dozen emails from people valuing companies. And here's how the email will go. I'm valuing a money-losing company. I expected to lose money forever. What type of valuation model do you think I should use to put a value on this company? You have a money-losing company. You expected to lose money forever. You think about paying for this company? What's wrong with you? That's when I should release the duh and leave it at that and let them figure out what's wrong with the question. So the duh proposition says if you have a money-losing company, expect to lose money forever, stop thinking about paying for the company, they should pay you. Which brings me to the third and final proposition. I'm going to call this the don't freak out proposition because some of you are going to freak out. I'll tell you when it's going to happen. You're going to pick a company this week because I nagged you. You're going to think you're all okay. You're going to download the financials. Sometime next week or the week after, I'm going to ask you to compute the cash flows last year for your company. Not even in the future, just let's not get ambitious. What is the cash flow last year? You're going to compute that cash flow, and you're going to come up with a negative number. And then you're going to freak out. You're going to show up in my office and say, I have to change companies. Why? Because my company has negative cash flows. So? Remember the duh proposition. This is what happens when you don't listen all the way through. In class. The duh proposition doesn't say that a company with negative cash flows last year or even next year is worth nothing. It's if your cash flows are negative forever that you have a problem. So let me ask you a question. If you have a company with negative cash flows last year, that you expect to have negative cash flows in the near future, first, what kinds of companies are likely to have negative cash flows in the near future? Think in terms of the life cycle. It's going to be young growth companies often. Why? Because when they're growing, they have to reinvest a lot. They're often not. So I can guarantee you that Snap's cash flow this year and next year and the year after and the year after and the year after and the year after are all going to be negative. Not because they're a bad company, but because they have a company with potential that they have to reinvest to create. But here's the catch. If you have negative cash flows up front, you can still be a valuable company if you get disproportionately large positive cash flows in the future. See what I mean by disproportionately large? You lose $1 billion in year one. You have to make $10 billion in year 10 to make up for that billion. Why? Because of risk and time value of money. We're going to value a few young growth companies, and I'll tell you up front, even before you see these valuations, what you're going to see. So when you see me value Amazon in 2000 or Twitter in 2013, you should expect to see negative cash flows in years one and two and three and four and five, precisely because they're young growth companies. But then you're going to see a disproportionately large positive cash flows in the future, making up for those negative cash flows. So if you pick a young growth company, I know some of you already sounded me out on picking young growth companies, don't be afraid of negative cash flows. It's not the end of the game. You just have to work through what happens once this company starts to mature. So with those propositions in mind, let's set up the framework for valuation. I'm going to use a balance sheet, but not an accounting balance sheet, a financial balance sheet as my basis for thinking about valuation. So I come to you with a business to value. Here's how I look at the company. I can break your assets down into assets in place, investments you've already made as a company, and growth assets. So if you're a growth company like Snap, much of your value comes from the growth assets. And on the other side of the balance sheet, you've got debt and equity. There are only two ways to fund a business. When you sit down to do valuation, you have to make a decision early on as to whether you want to value the entire business or just the equity in the business. Sounds like I'm playing games with words. But you can have valuable businesses where equity is worth nothing. Why? Because you borrowed a ton of money. So you have to make that judgment early on. Because here's how it matters. If you decide to value the equity in a business, you're going to stay focused on just the equity investors. So let's make this real. Let's suppose this is a business. You guys all be equity investors. You guys be lenders to the firm. I raise debt from you. I raise equity from you. Let's say I raise $200 million equity, $100 million in debt. I start the business. It starts doing well. I generate cash flows and earnings. Who gets first claim on those cash flows? They do, in the form of interest payments and principal payments. So I pay you. And if there are any cash flows left, or there's no guarantee that there will be, then what are my three choices? I can hold on to the cash because there's no legal obligation for me to return the cash. So like Google and Apple building up the cash, so I can hold on to the cash, that it's your cash. Don't try to do anything stupid based on that. You know, I want my cash and go to the bank and say, give me my share of the Apple cash balance. It doesn't work, but it's your cash technically. The second is I can pay dividends. And the third, increasingly in the U.S., is I can use the cash to buy back stock. But both of you generated cash from this business, right? You got cash in the form of interest and principal payments. You're getting cash in the form of dividends and buybacks. And when I do equity valuation, I forget all about those guys. I say, look, they can take care of themselves. I'm going to focus just on the equity investors. So let's say focus on the equity investors. I'm going to look at the cash flows you get from the company, either in dividends or buybacks or collectively. And I'm going to discount those cash flows at the rate of return you needed to make to invest in the equity. That sounds like a strange word. What do you mean needed to make? I mean, remember, you bought equity in my stock because you wanted to make money. It's a risky investment, so you might say, I expect to make 10, 12, 14, 15%. That's generically what the cost of equity is. It's what U.S. equity investors need to make to break even. So I'm going to take cash flows to equity, and I'm going to discount them back at the cost of equity and end up with the value of equity in the business. In fact, until about 30 years ago, the only way cash went back to equity investors was in the form of dividends. The oldest discounted cash flow model in use is the dividend discount model, where I take the dividends you receive as stockholders, I discount those dividends back at the cost of equity and I value equity. Increasingly, that model is breaking down because companies don't return what they can afford to in dividends. Some buy back stocks, some hold on to the cash. But you can see these are all equity-focused models where I think just about the equity investors. Everybody comfortable? So with equity valuation, I focus just on the equity investors, their cash flows discount back at the cost of equity. And the cash flows to equity are cash flows left over after I've made my debt payments. Here's the other way I can approach business. I can try to value the entire business. And what does that mean? I look at the collective cash flows that both of you made out of this business. So you got cash flows to equity, you got interest and dividend payments, right? So if I add the two together, I get a pre-debt cash flow. This is the cash flow from the entire business. And if that's the cash flow I'm discounting, I'm not going to be able to discount it at the cost of equity anymore. I have to discount it at a weighted average of what the equity investors want, which is the cost of equity, and what lenders want, which is the cost of debt, which in corporate finance is the cost of capital. Discounting cash flows the entire business back at the cost of capital, gives me the value of the entire business. And if I want to get to the value of equity, all I need to do is what? So let's say I value the entire business, but I'm still interested in buying shares in the company. I have to subtract out what I owe you, which is debt. And I'm going to start with that question, a very mechanical question. I value the entire business. I'm trying to think of what I should be subtracting out to get to the value of equity. And here are my four choices. I can subtract out the value of only long-term debt, saying I'm looking at only long-term capital. I can subtract out the value of all debt. I can subtract out the value of whatever I included as debt in my cost of capital calculation. And I leave that as a mysterious, what else could be in there? You might capitalize leases and decide to treat them as debt. You might decide to take pension fund, you know, that you have due. So that's the third choice. Or the fourth is you could subtract out all liabilities, which includes accounts payable, current liabilities, etc. So what do you think I should do? I value the entire business, taking cash flows to the business, discounting at the cost of capital. I'm trying to decide what debt to subtract out. Which of these four do you think I should go with? Long-term debt, total debt, whatever debt used in the cost of capital, or all liabilities? Think about it for just a few seconds. As I said, you might not be quite ready in terms of mechanics to answer that, but you have to subtract something up, right? I leave that unanswered because we're going to come back to this specifically, but you have to subtract out a debt that is consistent with what you call debt all the way through. I've kind of given away the answer. So through the entire process in your cost of capital calculation, you've been treating leases as debt. And you've been counting only long-term debt. At this stage, that's what you can treat as debt. So the choices you make as debt when you do the cost of capital will come back at a later stage in the process to get from value of the firm to value of equity. So let's say you've done this right. And you've taken the same company. You valued equity by taking cash flows to equity and discounting at the cost of equity. And you valued the equity by taking the value of the entire business and subtracting our debt. You got to the same company, same equity, right? So here's my next question. Should you get the same answer, the same value for equity, using both approaches? Let me ask you a different question. Would you like to get the same answer with both approaches? I would, and here's why. Can you imagine being an equity research analyst? You're valuing a company, you're doing an equity valuation, you find the company's undervalued. Then you do a firm valuation, subtract our debt, and you find it's overvalued. You're in huge trouble because a stock can't be both under and overvalued. They're both intrinsic valuation approaches. So I'll give you the easy part of the answer. If you do it right, you should get the same value for the equity. Saying, what does that mean? I'll give you a very simple example of what doing it right will involve. Let's suppose you come to me with a business and say, I'd like to value the equity in the business. And here are the numbers. You give me cash flows to equity. You give me cash flow to the firm. Cash flow to equity is what you guys make. The interest expense is the only cash flow that goes to the lenders. The collective cash flow is the cash flow to the firm. The cost of equity for this firm is 13.625%. And let's say it can borrow money long term at 10%. So that's a cost of debt pre-tax, but they have a 50% tax rate. The current market value of the equity and the market value of debt are given. And you're going to see in a minute why they have to be given. So there are two ways you can approach this valuation, right? You can take cash flows to equity and discount them back at the cost of equity. Let's try that. If I take cash flows to equity and discount at the cost of equity, the value of equity that I get for this company is $1,073 million. So that was easy. Or you can take cash flow to the firm. So if you go to the previous page, they take the cash flow to the firm and discount them at the cost of capital. So first thing is I have to compute what the cost of capital is. Cost of equity times the proportion of equity, which is based on the market values, plus cost of debt after taxes, because remember they get a 50% tax benefit on the debt, times the weight of debt, gives me a 9.9. So much lower cost of capital, but the value that I get for the business when I discount cash flows to the business at the cost of capital is $1,873 million. You subtract out the debt. Magic, I get the same value for equity with both approaches. I'll also tell you that I've cheated all over the place in this example. I had to make all kinds of tweaking assumptions for this to work. Remember I told you there's going to be a weekly challenge each week? This week's weekly challenge, I'm going to give you a very simple company to value. And then I'm going to ask you to value it by taking cash flows to equity in the cost. I'll give you all the numbers. So you're saying, I've never done a cash flow to equity. I'll do the dirty work of supplying you with the raw numbers. And then I'm going to ask you to take the same company, value the business, subtract our debt, and you're going to find that the equity numbers when you first do it are not going to match up. And I'm going to ask you, why do you think that happened? It's very unfair to ask this question. It's one of the toughest questions in DCF to answer. And I'm throwing it to you at the second week, but I want you to start thinking about why the two approaches sometimes deliver different answers, because you'll have to make choices along the way, and they will affect your final number. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a little tangent away from the notes to that one page that I sent you. So let me pull up that page and give you a little bit of background on what's on this page. So I know the numbers on up there are almost are very difficult to read. So if you have the slide that I passed out today, just take a look at that slide. So let me give you a little bit of background on where this page came from. It was actually from an acquisition that was done in 1979, where a company called Kennecott acquired a company called Carbon. Let me back up. Kennecott was a mining company. And in 1979, Kennecott had a subsidiary called Peabody Coal, which was a coal mining subsidiary, that the antitrust laws then required them to sell off. It's about a $2.5 billion company. It sells off this coal subsidiary. It gets $600 million in cash when it sells. So $2.5 billion, now you got the $600 million in cash coming in from the sale. So now you have $600 million in cash as Kennecott. And Kennecott's managers are terrified. What were they terrified about? What's the problem with having a lot of cash in your balance sheet? What were they worried about? Cash is good, right? So why worry about having a lot of cash? Yep. They were afraid that somebody would acquire them and use the cash to acquire them. Let me ask you a question. This is a corporate finance 101 question. You have a company with $600 million in cash that it has no use for. What's the most logical way to get rid of the cash if you don't want to have it? Give it back to the stockholders, dividends, buybacks, I don't care. It's the easiest way to... That thought never even crossed their minds. They said, what would stockholders do with all this cash? Stupid things like pay off the mortgage, buy a new car. We can't allow that. So let me ask you a second question. What's the stupidest way to get rid of $600 million in cash quickly? They went to First Boston, at that time the leading M&A bank on the street, and they said, we have $600 million in cash that we need to spend quickly. Can you help us? It's like walking into Bloomingdale's, wagging a big stack of currency, walking up and saying, I need to spend $5,000 in the next 30 minutes. Can you help me? They work on commission. You're going to be surrounded by salespeople. And First Boston said, no problem. We'll find the perfect target for you. And they went on a search mission. And they found a company called Carborundum. And coincidentally, they said, you'll be able to buy Carborundum for $660 million, which happens to be exactly the cash you have on your balance sheet. That's another rule in acquisitions. You tell a banker how much cash you have available to spend. Magically, the value of the target company will equate to the cash. So now First Boston says, we found a target for you. It's worth $660 million. And this would have just gone into the annals of bad acquisitions and nobody would have noticed. But here's what happened to it. It became a Harvard case study. It was a strategic case. Nobody in Harvard ever looks at the numbers anyway. Everything is strategic, which tells you a little bit about a Harvard case study. And you're so basically, the way you were supposed to analyze this case is draw, you know, those matrices of cash cows, dogs, pigs, you know, barnyard animals wandering around, you know, and talk, this is a good fit kind of thing. But I think accidentally, as one of the exhibits on the case, they put up the cash flows that First Boston used to justify the $660 million. So I'm going to take you through how First Boston computed these cash flows. And at the end of the process, I want you to think about a very specific question. What discount rate would you apply on these cash flows? And look at the bottom. I'm going to give you six choices. So I want you to start thinking about which of those choices you would go to. So I'll describe how the cash flows were computed, and you tell me which of these choices you'd make. So here's what First Boston did. It projected out the revenues and the operating expenses for Carborundum. It got the operating income. It subtracted out interest expenses, came up with net income, added back depreciation, subtracted out reinvestment and debt payments to come up with cash flows. Let me repeat what they did, and I want you to think about what cash flows they've computed. They started with operating income, subtracted interest expenses, came up with net income, subtracted out reinvestment, CapEx and working capital, and then subtracted out debt payments. That's how they came up with the cash flows. So they've come up with cash flows. You need a discount rate, right? So I'm going to ask you in very generic terms, given how they've computed cash flows, what discount rate they should apply on these cash flows. First, should you be discounting these cash flows at a cost of equity or a cost of capital? Why equity? Because I subtracted out interest expenses and debt payments, so these are cash flows to equity, right? Everybody get that? If I computed cash flows before debt payments, before interest and debt, then there would have been cash flows to firm. So you have cash flows to equity. So half, you can cross out that half, which says cost of capital. So basically, no, you should. Now let me ask you a follow-up question. And this, I think, is a question that most M&A bankers would get wrong. Whose cost of equity should I use to discount these cash flows? And I'll give you the three choices. I can discount these cash flows back at the acquiring company's cost of equity, the rationale being they're coming up with the money, it's their cost of equity that matters. I could discount these cash flows at the target company's cost of equity, because it's their cash flows, or maybe I should be using some merged cost of equity to the combined firm. So I'm going to go through each of the choices. So everybody okay with the cost of capital being knocked out, right? So how many of you would use the acquiring company's cost of equity? You ready to be my guinea pig? I'm going to make you play along. I'll let you be the guinea pig. Okay? So let's carry this to the next step. So why are you using the acquiring company's cost of equity? Because it's their money, right? So in this case, you're buying a risky company and you're using your, so the fact is that you're a safe company, you have a low cost of equity, you're valuing a risky company using a safe. You see where this is going to carry you? It's a logical extreme. Every risky company you look at is going to look cheap to you, right? You're going to buy risky company after risky company. Every company looks cheap, not because the company is cheap, but because you're subsidizing that company with your safe businesses. An acquiring company's cost of equity or capital shouldn't even belong in the discussion in an acquisition because it goes back to capital budgeting and corporate finance. What's the rule in capital budgeting? What discount rate should you apply to a project? It should be based on the risk of the project, not the risk of the entity looking at the project. If I came to you with a riskless project today, what should you use as your discount rate? Let's say it's in U.S. dollars. You should be using about 2.5% as your discount. You think that is absurd. Why would I settle for a 2.5%? Because it's risk-free. This has nothing to do with what your cost of capital is or cost of equity is as an acquiring company. It's got everything to do with the risk of the cash flows you're discounting. So you shouldn't use the acquiring company. The merge company doesn't even make sense because you're going into between. You should be using the target company's cost of equity, which in this case would be 16.5%. It's actually a very, very difficult concept to grapple with because we've all been taught about the cost of capital as being the cost of raising financing. That's an awful definition. The cost of capital that we use in valuation is an opportunity cost of investing in something else of equivalent risk, which effectively means you have to go with the target company's cost of equity and cost of capital. We'll come back and grapple with this more when we talk about acquisition valuation. But you should have been using 16.5%. Yeah. You still have a subsidy, right? So if you have a safe entity buying a risky entity, you go in the middle, what have you done, right? You've essentially, again, subsidized the risky business with the safe business's cash flows. You want the risky business to stand on its own 2 feet because otherwise you're going to be buying lots of risky business. Do you think companies actually end up making this mistake? AT&T, through the entire 90s, almost destroyed itself as a company because it did acquisition after acquisition. They all looked cheap. You know why? Because they were taking their cost of equity and capital, which was a low number, applying it to all these risky technology businesses. You cannot do that because you're violating a corporate finance first principle. 16.5%. What do you think First Boston used as its discount rate? What's the worst possible choice you can make? First, they used the cost of capital instead of a cost of equity, and they used the acquiring company's cost of capital. So the So instead of using a 16.5% discount rate, they used a 10.5% discount rate, which is how they came up with a value that exceeded the $660 million, which is the basis for the advice they gave to Kennecott, go do that acquisition, it looks good for you. All you have to do is take their own cash flows. You don't even have to change a single one of their assumptions and use the right discount rate here. And if you do that, the value that you get for Carborundum drops to $450 million, in which case, what have you done? You advised your client to pay $660 million for a company that's worth $450 million. And whose name is on top of the valuation? First Boston, at that time, the leading M&A bank. You're saying, why even name them? Because it's so easy to get intimidated when you see names on top. Goldman Sachs, KKR. You assume that because you see a big name on a valuation, they must know what they're doing. It's a horrible mistake. Because I've seen some really big name valuations do really stupid things. So don't let the names intimidate you. Step back and ask those fundamental questions. Any questions on this acquisition? On this set of cash flows, the use of the discount rate. So here's my first principle of valuation, the principle I'm going to come back to again and again. You tell me how you estimated the cash flows. I'll tell you what the right kind of discount rate for those cash flows is. If your cash flows are after debt payments, your discount rate has to be a cost of equity. If your cash flows are pre-debt cash flows, your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. The one thing you could never do in valuation is mix and match. Know what I mean by mix and match? Take that example that I just gave you. So in this page, put a big X on top, because on the quiz, I don't want you to end up on this page in a hurry and do all the things that I'm doing here. These are things you shouldn't do. I could take the cash flows to equity and discount them back at the cost of capital. If I do, I'm going to overvalue the company. Why? Because I'm taking cash flows to equity, which are risky cash flows, and discounting at a cost of capital, which are operating risk cash flows. If I take cash flows to the firm and discount at the cost of equity, I'm going to undervalue the firm. I'm going to push my number. But if you take cash flow to equity and discount at the cost of capital, you probably have no idea what you're valuing in the first place, right? It's half equity, half firm. You might end up saying, well, I've already valued equity, and end up forgetting to subtract our debt. There are lots of pathways you can adopt here which can lead you to the wrong answer. So before you get too involved in estimating the cash flows, stop and ask yourself, what type of cash flows am I estimating? Are they pre-debt or post-debt? Okay. And don't use other people's cash flows without asking those questions to make sure you're applying the right discount rate. So now let's start digging into the specifics of discounted cash flow valuation. I'm going to take you through five steps, and this is going to take us probably the next five, maybe 6 weeks to do. I'm going to start off talking about discount rates. Might as well start with that comfort zone that many of you can draw on what you've learned in corporate finance already. I'm going to talk about cost of equity versus cost of capital, the inputs that go in there. I'm going to talk about different currencies. If I ask you to compute the cost of capital for Tata Motors in Indian rupees, how would you do it as opposed to US dollars, learning how to deal with different currencies? Maybe dealing with things in real terms, where you forget inflation entirely versus nominal terms. So I want you to get comfortable with discount rates in different currencies for different kinds of companies, and also with the fact that discount rates can change over time. In other words, you're valuing Snap. The cost of capital attached to year one's cash flows can be very different from the cost of capital attached to year five or year 10 cash flows, because on your spreadsheet, as Snap goes from a money-losing to a money-making company, your cost of capital needs to change. Then we're going to move on to just looking at current earnings and cash flow. So before we get ambitious, we're going to open up the last year's annual report, 10K, 10Q, whatever you have, and talk about how do we come up with earnings and cash flows for last year. That sounds like it should be trivial to do, right? You're going to be surprised at how many little details there are in just getting the cash flows for last year. Forget about the future. So that's going to be our second step. Up till that step, you're going to feel pretty comfortable because you're drawing on numbers that are out there. The third step, I'm going to ask you to estimate future earnings and cash flows. You know what your first reaction is going to be? Too much uncertainty. So many different things can happen. Remember what we said in valuation, don't look for confirmation. You basically have to come up with your best estimates given what you know today and accept the fact that 3 weeks or 6 weeks into the class, your entire company valuation might change because something comes out that changes your perspective. So we're going to talk about growth and cash flows. Then I'm going to ask you to put closure on your valuation. And you'd see what I mean by that is you can't estimate cash flows forever. So at some point in time, you want to stop. But you can't ignore what happens after that point in time. We're going to talk about how to put closure in valuation so that you can do a valuation of a company that potentially lasts forever without having to estimate cash flows forever. And finally, we'll talk about how do you decide. There are lots of different versions of discounted cash flow models floating around. You can do an equity valuation, a firm valuation, a high growth or a stable growth. We're going to talk about how to decide which of these models is right for your company. And it'll be different for different companies. So let's start this process off by looking at a generic discounted cash flow model. If you look at no matter how complex a discounted cash flow model becomes, here are the pieces that you will see in almost any discounted cash flow model. First, you're going to see cash flows. Those cash flows can either be before debt payments or after debt payments. If they're before debt payments, they're to the firm. If they're after debt payments, they're to equity. Then you're going to see a growth rate. That growth rate can be an operating income, which is income to the entire firm, or a growth rate in equity income, net income, earnings per share. Not all growth rates are made equal. Your discount rate can be a cost of equity or a cost of capital. And as I said, there's closure that you need. At some point in time, you have to stop estimating cash flows. And here I want to bring up something that we're going to have to deal with more fully later on. In theory, a publicly traded company can last forever. But as I said, in practice, you can't estimate cash flows forever. So you want to stop. You say, can I stop now? How about right now? And I'll make a deal with you. You can stop if you're willing to make an assumption. And the assumption's going to scare you. The assumption you have to make is beyond that point in time, wherever you stop, your cash flows have to grow at a constant rate forever. See why this scares people? Forever. You know what that buys you? It buys you an infinite series in mathematics. And 200 years ago, mathematicians solved for the value of this infinite series. It's one equation. It's been around in mathematics forever. We stole it in finance. We act like we invented this. But this is how we put closure. We estimate cash flows for 5 or 10 years. At the end of 10 years, we assume cash flows grow at a constant rate. We use that mathematical equation for the present value of all cash flows beyond that and say that's it's called the terminal value. All it does is it captures what happens after that. But to do that, what do you have to assume? That your cash flows grow at a constant rate forever, right? So I'm going to draw on the Spider-Man. You know, with great power comes great responsibility. This is a very powerful equation. You can do real damage to valuation. So if you tell me your cash flows will grow at a constant rate forever, that growth rate cannot exceed the growth rate of the economy you're in, right? Think of why. Mathematically, you let a company grow faster than the economy. What's going to happen? It's going to become the economy, then it'll implode. So, and that's why I ask you the final question. When will your company be a mature company? Because if you tell me it's a mature company, to me a mature company is one that grows at a rate less than or equal to the economy. I can put that closure equation, say I'm done, and value the company. So if you think about the generic questions, what are your cash flows? What is your discount rate? What's your growth rate? When will you be a mature company? Every single discounted cash flow model is built around those four. Now let's start simple. If I came to you with a dividend discount model, let's think about how you answer each of these questions. When I ask you, what are your cash flows? The cash flows you offer me are expected dividends on the stock. The growth is going to be a growth rate in those dividends. Your discount rate is going to be a cost of equity because dividends go to equity investors. And your closure is going to come about when you tell me your dividends will start to grow at a constant rate forever. So with dividend discount models, cash flows are dividends, discount rate is cost of equity, growth rate is a growth rate in equity income and dividends. No, and closure comes about when you think your company will start growing at a constant rate forever in terms of equity earnings and dividends. That's with the dividend discount model. Somewhere in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to introduce an alternative to the dividend discount model. And I'm going to draw on a concept that I go through in corporate finance, but if you weren't in my corporate finance class, let me compress what the concept is. Dividends are what companies pay. I'm going to measure potential dividends. That sounds like a fancy thing, right? I'm going to look at what cash is left over after a company has met every conceivable need, capital expenditures, working capital, debt payments. I can go to the statement of cash flows for any company and compute that number. Last year, for instance, Apple's potential dividend was $55 billion. This company is a cash machine. Apple last year returned $35 billion to stockholders, the most returned by any company in the face of the earth. So if I used a dividend discount model or variant, I'm going to use the $35 billion. But when I compute potential dividends, I'm going to use the $55 billion. See the advantage this gives me? Even if a company chooses not to pay dividends, like Google, I can still value them if I can estimate potential dividend. I'm going to give that potential dividend a name. I call it free cash flow equity. We'll come back and be specific about it, but it's just a fancy name for saying this is the cash flow left over after every conceivable need has been met. If I'm valuing a company based on potential dividends, my cash flow is now going to be this potential dividend I've computed. The growth rate in that potential dividend is going to become the growth rate I use in the model. My discount rate is still a cost of equity. It's still an equity cash flow. And closure will be when that potential dividend starts to grow at a rate less than the economy. So very subtle shift. I've replaced actual dividends with potential dividends. The rest of the model goes through. And finally, if you ask me to value the entire business, let's see how the definition changes. Now, instead of looking at cash flows after debt payments, I look at cash flows before debt payments, cash flow to the firm, pre-debt cash flows. Instead of discounting at the cost of equity, I discount at the cost of capital. And when you ask for growth, I give you growth in operating income, not in net income. And finally, I put closure when your operating income starts to grow at a constant rate forever. What I'm trying to say is we're going to be looking at discounted cash flow model after discount. And after a while, you said there are 12 different models here. And what I'm trying to point out is at their core, all these models are trying to do the same thing. But how you define cash flows, discount rates, growth rates, and closure is what's going to set these models apart. In fact, I pulled them all together, and I'll show the comparison when I get to cash flows, of comparing these models on what you do. But that's going to be how we approach valuation, is answering those four questions. Now, at this stage, you're saying, but how do we come up with cash flows? How do we come up with discount rates? How do we know what growth is? When do we put closure? Those are the specifics I want to kind of clean up over the next few weeks, because without that, all you have are abstractions. So let's start with discount rates. It's the D in the DCF, right? Do discount rates matter? Obviously, it is a discounted cash flow valuation. Having said that, though, discount rates don't matter as much as you think they do. What I mean by that, and often in discounted cash flow valuations, people spend so much time on the discount rate that they hardly have time to think about cash flows. So one of the things I'm going to come back to as I talk about the specifics of discount rates is being consistent. One of the things about consistency we talked about, if your cash flows are after debt payments, your discount rate has to be a cost of equity. If your cash flows are before debt payments, your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. I'm going to build on that consistency thing. If your cash flows are in Mexican pesos, your discount rate has to be in Mexican pesos as well. If you decide to do everything in real terms, decide to take inflation entirely out of your cash flows, your discount rate has to be a real discount rate as well. So when you think about what discount rate should I use, look at how you computed your cash flows. The clues are going to lie there as to how you should compute discount rates. So let's start this process by looking at how we come up with discount rates. I don't want to dive into theory and models because it kind of makes us lose our way. So here's how I think about estimating discount rates to use on cash flows. I'm going to start with a risk-free rate. In whatever currency you've chosen to do your valuation in, and some currencies it's easier to get that number than others. I'll start that. I'm going to come up with a measure of how risky your company is relative to the typical company in the market. You can call that number a beta. You can call it whatever you want. But that's my second input. And the third is, I'm going to look at what the market is charging for risk in the equity markets. That's an equity risk premium. I need a risk-free rate, I need a measure of relative risk, and I need an equity risk premium. And in doing all of this, you have to decide whose risk you're going to try to measure. And let me be specific. When you sit down to value a company, here's something that I find useful. Sit down and make a list of every conceivable risk that you think this company is exposed to. So if it's a biotechnology company, it might be FDA approval process, healthcare plan changes. So if you're thorough, you're going to end up with 10, 15, 20 items on the list. Here's what I'd like you to do after you've made that list. Start putting the risk into buckets. Let me explain. Your risk can be estimation risk or economic risk. What's the difference? Estimation risk is risk because you haven't done your homework. You haven't collected the data. You've ignored things. Economic risk comes from things you can't control. Now, here's why I think it's so critical drawing this distinction. Let's say you're valuing a Greek company. Not suggesting any of you have to pick a Greek, but let's say you decide to value a Greek company. You do all of your homework. You collect all the data you can. How much of the risk in this company do you think is within your control? Probably 10, 12, 15%. And I'm going to argue that in many companies, most of the risk you face has nothing to do with your estimation problems. It's got everything to do with underlying economic risk. There's a moment in valuation where you've got to let go. So when you start making your estimates, you want to collect more data. You want to finesse it. You want to make it even more specific. There's a point where you have to say, that's all I can do. Much of the risk in this company is out of my control. I can't get better estimates just by spending more time on it. I have to make my best estimates and move on. Estimation risk versus economic risk. Estimation risk you can reduce by doing more homework. Economic risk you can do nothing about. I'm going to value Snap next week. And guess what? 95% of the risk in that company is economic risk. It's understanding what business they're in, who the competition is going to be, there's nothing I can do about it. I can't beat myself up. So what if I'm wrong? I know I'm going to be wrong even before I do the valuation. But much of the risk is risk that I cannot make go away by doing more research. Second, I'm going to ask you, is it micro risk or macro risk? Micro risk is risk directly related to the company. Who's running the company, what their products are, what the competition is doing. So in the case of Valiant, it's going to be management questions. What happens to the product? What are the legal? Those are micro risk. What are macro risk? Give me a good example of a macro risk. When's the next meeting for the Fed, the Federal Open Market Committee? We're all sit there with bated breath waiting for, are they going to raise rates? Are they going to lower rates? Let's assume the Fed has the power that you think they do and that it can raise rates. That's macro risk. You say, why draw the distinction? Micro risk is diversifiable. You know what I mean by diversifiable? You value 30 companies. The micro risks are going to cut both ways. Sometimes you're going to underestimate the risk. Macro risk, there's nothing you can do. It's going to exist, whether you have 20 companies or 30 companies. Only macro risk shows up in your discount rate if you're a diversified investor. The micro risk you average out. And finally, you have to ask, is this discrete risk or continuous risk? Remember the example I gave you for Venezuela? 100 million, that's pretty much guaranteed. The 90% of the time that nobody does anything to you. The 10% of the time that there's a nationalization, all your money is gone. That is discrete risk. Nationalization risk is discrete risk. Distress risk is discrete risk. Continuous risk is the risk that your cash flows 5 years from now might be different from what you've estimated. We're very good at dealing with continuous risk in finance. We're terrible at dealing with discrete risk. So we're going to confront discrete risk. What happens when you value a company which has nationalization risk or a biotech company where you have approval risk, and talk about how to bring those into valuation? Because after you've looked at all these risks, I'm going to make you step back and ask, you're valuing this company. Whose risk should you be using in valuing the company? That sounds like a stupid question. You say, I'm valuing the company, I should use my risk. It's not that easy. You and I have to be price takers on some things. You know what I mean by price takers? We're not big enough investors to go and say, I want my price of risk. So when you value companies, and this is where corporate finance has made the changes in the way we think about risk in the last 60 years, the Markowitz revolution, the risk that we capture in our discount rate should reflect the marginal investor in the company, not you and I. You and I are not marginal investors. You know why? Because to be a marginal investor, what do you need? Does anybody remember from corporate finance the two components that make an investor a marginal investor? One is you need to own a lot of stock in the company. When I say lot of stock, I'm talking about millions of shares, not thousands of shares, and you need to trade those shares. You look at risk in a company through their eyes, and that actually simplifies your life, because in most companies, you think about the kinds of investors who own lots of shares and trade those shares. Those investors are likely to be Fidelity and State Street and Barclays and Vanguard, institutional investors, which changes the way you think about risk, because when you think about risk then, it's risk through their eyes. That's where all of the different risk and return models come into play. Every single risk and return model in finance measures risk to a diversified investor. It makes the implicit assumption that the investors pricing these stocks on the margin are diversified investors. You say, what if that's not true? We'll come back and we have to confront it, because value private businesses, we can't make that assumption. If you gave me a small, lightly traded Middle Eastern company, I'm on dangerous ground assuming the margin investor is a diversified investor. So we'll come back and talk about what to do when you don't want this assumption, but with this assumption, you get all of the different risk and return models in finance. As I said, I don't want to kind of get lost in these models, but if you look at what these models do, let's start with the CAPM. You start with the risk-free rate, right? You measure the risk of a stock with a beta. What does beta capture again? The risk added by that stock to a diversified investor's portfolio. There's the diversified investor. You assume that all of that risk can be captured with one beta. That's a pretty strong assumption, but with the CAPMs, you know, no transactions cost, no private information we get there. The cost of equity in the CAPM is the risk-free rate plus the beta times a risk premium for that. If you look at the arbitrage pricing model and multi-factor models, here's the only difference. Instead of having one beta and one risk premium, you could have five betas, but they're still capturing the risk you cannot diversify away, but they come from five different places. And if you look at proxy models, and these are the models that became popular in the early 1990s, what you do is you let something else stand in for risk, the size of the company. If you're a small company, you must be risky. If you have a low price to book, you must be risky. But in all of these models, you start with the risk-free rate. That's what they share in common. And in all of these models, you assume that the marginal investor is diversified. They share a lot more than they differ on. So for all of these models, what's the one number that you need to get started? You need a risk-free rate. Without a risk-free rate, you're lost, right? So that's what we're going to start in today's session, is start talking about risk-free rates. So whatever the model is, if you look at the base, every single one of these models, whether it's a CAPM, the arbitrage pricing model, the multi-factor model, you need to start with the risk-free rate. In every one of these models, you then have to grapple with what's the price of risk and the measure of risk. We'll come back to those, but we'll start with the risk-free rate. So let's start with what makes something risk-free. I'm going to take you back all the way to the start of whatever your foundations in finance class was, your beginning finance class. For something to be risk-free, you need to know exactly what you will make on this investment with certainty. Right? That's the definition of risk-free. So I ask you, what will you make on this investment? What do you make and what do you expect to make will be the same number. There is no variance around that number because it's guaranteed. So think of what you need for something to be risk-free. First, there can be no default risk in the entity issuing the security. File that away. So if I give you a bond, but the entity issuing the bond has some default risk, that bond rate cannot be a risk-free rate. Sounds like I'm stating the obvious. Might as well state it. Second, I cannot tell you what a risk-free rate is unless you tell me your time horizon. So if you tell me what's a risk-free rate over the next 6 months, the answer you're going to get is going to be very different than if you ask me what's a risk-free rate over the next 5 years. So let's draw from that definition and see what it means. First, time horizon matters. When you think about risk-free rates, we have to be specific. Never answer the question in an interview, what's the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars? It could be 0.3% if your time horizon is 3 months. It could be 2.5% if it's 10 years. It could be 3.25% if it's 30 years. So time horizon matters. Second, never answer the question, what's the risk-free rate, unless I tell you what currency I'm talking about. Don't assume it's always U.S. dollars. Why should it be? The risk-free rate in Mexican pesos is going to be different from the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars, which is going to be different from the risk-free rate in Indian rupees. We'll talk about why the differences exist, but risk-free rates will vary across currencies. And finally, just because you have a government bond rate doesn't mean you have a risk-free rate. Unfortunately, in many classes, you're told if it's a government bond rate, it must be risk-free. When you say that, what are you implicitly assuming about governments? That governments never default. And the justification that people offer is when a government issues bonds in the local currency, they never have to default. Why? They can print more currency. And my counter to that is 25% of all sovereign defaults that have happened in the last 50 years have been in local currency bonds. So why might governments default in the local currency? I mean, if they can print more currency, why don't they just print more money and just pay off the debt? Is there a cost to doing that, just printing more money? What happens if you do that? You don't default, but you debase your currency. Inflation goes up. So here, you're between a rock and a hard place. You borrowed money that you can't repay. You have one of two pathways you can go. One is you can print more money and pay off the debt and debase your currency, or you can default on the debt and deal with default. And you know what? History suggests that defaulting is actually less painful than debasing your currency, because if you debase your currency, your own people lose trust in the currency. They never, ever want to hold your currency again. So let's dispense with this notion that just because you have a government bond rate, you have a risk-free rate. So let's think about how to come up with risk-free rates. And I'm going to start with a very simple test. So we'll go through a series of tests, and let's see if at the end you can nail down risk-free rates. So our first task is to get a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars for valuation purposes. Valuation, what do? We estimate cash flows, not just for next year, the 2 years. So basically, it's for a very long term, and we discount those cash flows back to get to the value. I'm doing my cash flows in U.S. dollars. I'm doing it as of right now. And here are my choices, and you tell me which of these choices I would use as my risk-free rate. So I'm asking a very, very specific question in a dollar valuation. I could use a three-month T-bill rate. What's wrong with that? Because my cash flows are not just for the next 3 months, or when they basically last forever. So a three-month T-bill rate doesn't work, not because it's not default-free, but because it doesn't match up to the maturity of my cash flow. So short-term default-free rate will never work in valuation because your cash flows are long-term. How about a 10-year T-bond rate? We're getting closer. You're saying, well, I'd like even longer. I could give you a 30-year T-bond rate. But in the use of both, you're assuming the Treasury doesn't default. But if you're willing to make that assumption, you could argue the 30-year is better than the 10-year. You know what? If all you had to do was estimate risk-free rates, a 30-year T-bond rate is a better estimate of a risk-free rate than a 10-year T-bond rate. But in every valuation you're going to see me do in this class, I'm going to stay with a 10-year bond rate, and here's why. It's a pragmatic reason. The rest of the inputs I need to get to the cost of equity and the cost of debt, default spreads and equity risk premiums, are far easier to get when I use a 10-year bond rate than a 30-year bond rate. Let me give you a very simple example. To get to the cost of debt, here's what I need. I need a risk-free rate, and I need default spreads. Credit spreads based on how risky you are. The way you get credit spreads is you go looking for corporate bonds of equivalent maturity. If I pick 30-year government bonds as my risk-free rate, I need to find 30-year corporate bonds. Those are almost impossible to find. They're very few. So I use the 10-year T-bond rate, accepting that if this was the only choice I had to make, I'd go with the 30-year, but I'm going to go with the 10-year. Why can't I use a TIPS rate? Word of TIPS, these are inflation-protected bonds where you're guaranteed a real rate of return. So right now the TIPS rate is about 0.5% or 0.75%. What's wrong with that in my valuation? My valuation is in nominal dollars. A TIPS rate is like a real risk-free rate. We'll come back and talk about if you're doing a real valuation, whether this is the risk-free rate that you would use. But if I were doing my valuation in U.S. dollars, my risk-free rate would be 2.5%. You know what I'm going to do right after I pick that as my risk-free rate? I'm going to get down on my knees. I'm going to look up at the sky and say, please, God, let there be no Treasury risk, default risk in the U.S. Treasury. Because if there is default risk in the U.S. Treasury, I can't even use the 10-year bond rate as my risk-free rate. So that was the first stop. U.S. dollar valuations, those of you doing U.S. dollar valuation, don't use 2.5 because I don't know what it is right now. Look up the 10-year bond rate. That becomes your risk-free rate. That was easy. Let's say that you're doing a valuation in euros. You're doing a nice Spanish company, Zara. You have your cash flows in euros. You need a risk-free rate in euros. So you go looking for government bond rates in euros, and you find a dozen. And the rates are all different. You're saying, well, it's easy. I'll use the Spanish 10-year bond rate. These are all euro bonds. They're all 10-year euro bonds. So how come they're all different? Why are the rates different? I'll give an easy way to think about it. Why is the Greek 10-year euro bond rate so much higher than the German 10-year euro bond rate? Because people are worried that Greece might default. So you can see the next step. A Greek 10-year bond rate can never be used as a risk-free rate. Why? Because there is default risk in it. And already, in a sense, I've given away the answer to this question. If I'm valuing a Spanish company in euros, which of these rates should I use as my risk-free rate? I'm going to use the German rate, not because it's German, but because it's the lowest of the 10-year rates, and that'll become my risk-free rate in every euro bet. Now, part of you is saying, but I want to punish this company for being Spanish. guess what? I'll give you lots of chances to punish this company. Just don't do it in the risk-free rate. That was euros. Let's move one step further up the ladder. Let's suppose you're valuing an Indian company. Anybody deciding to value an Indian company? Okay, good. Let's say you decide to do the right thing and value the company in Indian rupees. You want an Indian rupee risk-free rate. So you do your homework. You go collect a government bond rate. On January 1st, 2017, the 10-year Indian government bond rate was 6.4%. I think this is good. I'm done. That's my rupee risk-free rate. This is an Indian rupee, so make sure you have a rupee-denominated bond. But before you use it as a risk-free rate, what do you need to stop and check? Make sure it's default-free. So I decided to do a stop. I went to the Moody's website. That's very lazy. Well, what else am I going to do? I can't assess sovereign default risk for 100 countries. And according to Moody's, the sovereign rating for India at the start of 2017 was Baa3. Not bad, but not AAA. So what's Moody's saying? There is default risk. In fact, Moody's gives you two ratings for every country, a local currency rating and a foreign currency rating. I was looking under the local currency rating, hoping I'd find AAA, but I found Baa3. So that's telling me that 6.4% is not quite risk-free, right? That some of it is for default risk. Now, I actually estimated a spread, a default spread, for that rating of 2.54%. I'll come back and talk about how I came up with the 2.54%, because this is a process when you pick a currency, you have to come up with the actual number. So next session, we'll go through ways of coming up with a spread, but that's my default spread. So let's do an algebra problem. The Indian rupee government bond rate is 6.4%, right? If you trust my measure of default risk and default spread, it looks like 2.54% of that 6.4% is for default risk. I want a risk-free rate in Indian rupees. So I'm going to list off some choices, and you tell me whether this is the right way to estimate a risk-free rate. I could say, who cares about this default stuff? I'm just going to stay with the 6.4%. In which case, what have you done? You built in some default risk into what you called risk-free, which already is a problem, and then you're going to add on other risk premiums. You'll end up double counting or triple counting risk. I could add the 2.54% to the 6.4%. In which case, I've actually ended up double counting the spread, right? Which kind of leads you, I've led you to the right answer, hopefully. I subtract out the spread, my risk-free rate in Indian rupees. If you trust the government bond rate and the default spread is 3.86%. You're saying, again, but it's an Indian rupee. Should you be using a higher rate? Unless you're some kind of, you can sense risk-free rates in the air. Don't go around feeling out what you think should be the right number. It is what it is. Let the rest of the numbers take care of themselves as you go along. So with risky currencies, don't use the government bond rate as a risk-free rate. Try to back out the spread. So let me at least start the process of how I come up with default spread. That 2.54%, where did that come from? There are three ways you can get default spreads for countries. One is, if you can find a dollar or euro-denominated bond issued by that country, you can compare the rate on that dollar or euro-denominated bond to something risk-free. So if you gave me a Brazilian dollar-denominated bond today, and you told me the rate on that bond is 6%, and the rate on a 10-year T-bond is 2.5%, the difference is a default spread. But this works only if you can find a sovereign bond issued by that country in dollars. You can't compare a rupee bond to a dollar bond. That's the first. Until about 10 years ago, this is the only way you could get default spreads. The second is use a market that is of more recent vintage. It's called the Sovereign Credit Default Swap Market, or the CDS market. It's a market that trades every minute of every day, and when something happens, the market will reflect it. It's an insurance market. So if you bought a Brazilian bond and you wanted to buy protection against default, you could go to the sovereign CDS market and buy insurance. It's an annual cost of insurance. So it's like a default spread in a market. So if you can find a sovereign CDS spread, you can come up with the sovereign CDS spread for your country, and that will then become your measure of default risk. But if you don't have dollar-denominated bonds and you don't have sovereign CDS spreads, you're kind of desperate. There, if you can give me your rating as a country, just as I did for India, the Moody's rating, I can have a lookup table where I say, if you tell me your rating, this is what the spread will look like for your company. Okay? I know you guys want to get out of here, but let me set up what we're going to do when we start class on Wednesday. I'm going to start with these government bond rates. These are just government bond rates. They're not risk-free rates. I was able to find them for about 45 currencies. And I'll send you the link to where I can pull up the data. Right? I'm going to take these government bond rates and make them into risk-free rates in each currency by looking up the default spreads, if any, in each currency. So by the time we're done, we're going to end up with risk-free rates in every one of these currencies, which means when you're doing valuation of these currencies, you at least know where to start. Of an alias that draws on the registered list, there might be a lag between when they let you into the class and when it shows up on the email list. I mean, I could add you, but that doesn't take care of the problem. You want to make sure that you're getting on that there's no problem. So go upstairs, you know, and tell them that you're registering the class, you're not getting it, that I'm using the alias that they create. Because what the alias does is it takes all the emails of the registered students in the class and puts them in, so all the emails should be going to them. So it's not coming to you, you're not showing up on that list yet. Okay. There might be a 3-day or a 5-day lag between the time you register and the time you show up on that list. That might explain it, because there are people who dropped the class last week who are still getting the emails. Okay. So it might just be the lag in the process.
Professor,
yeah.
In the original syllabus for the project, it said that we have to choose one foreign company, and then in one of the emails it said an emerging market company. So
it could be foreign.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of questions.
Yep.
The first was, so you were saying how, like, if you're investing in a foreign currency, you use a different risk-free rate.
I'm saying the analysis is in a currency, your discount rate has to be in the same currency. You can invest in whatever currency you want.
Yeah,
but when you do your analysis, when you value an Indian company, you can value an Indian company in rupees, you can value it in U.S. dollars, you can value it in euros, you can value it in pesos.
Okay.
Currency is a choice. Once you make the currency choice, that currency choice will drive both your discount rate and your cash flow.
Right. So, then, like, let's say you're a U.S. investor.
Doesn't matter. Don't make it about geography, right? You get an Indian investor, you can look at Infosys and value it in U.S. dollars, right? So, no. So, let's say you're an investor looking at an Indian company. You decide to value it in U.S. dollars or rupees.
Okay. So, let's say you're deciding to value it in U.S. dollars. And
yeah.
You use U.S. risk-free rate. Would you, in the report in rupee, would you use forward rates?
We'll talk about that. When you get to the cash flows, you have to be consistent. When we talk about why risk-free rates vary across currencies, the answer to what type of exchange rates we should be using will be in that. Because now, whatever drives differences in risk-free rates across currencies should be reflecting in the exchange rate.
Okay, great. And then the other question I had was, like, I think what you said before was the cost of raising financing shouldn't be the way we think about cost of capital. And instead, it should more be like required return or
given the risk. So you could raise money at 11%, but I come to you with an absolutely safe project on which you can make 5%. You should jump on it like crazy.
Right.
Even though it's well below what you told your investors you'd make. I've come to you with something risk-free. 5% beats 2.5%, so you're going to take that.
Right. So why is there a difference, I guess, in like how you think about...
There's really no difference, right? Because once you start deciding cost of capital, what the market then tries to do, attach a cost of capital to the company, is look at the risk of... So the minute you invest in something risk-free, people are going to bring down their risk for your company. It's not going to stay at 11%. It's going to drop now because you're a safer company.
Yeah, and I guess that like ties back to like the certainty equivalence thing that you're harping on. Okay, cool. That makes sense. Thank you.
Oh, good.
We
We just have a question about the emails. We both joined the class late, and neither one of us is
doing it. There's a lag, I think, because I know that people... The problem with my adding people is it's a Google alias. So basically, the alias...